From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. This week, we revisit our conversation with Aubrey Plaza and Emily the Criminal director, John Patton Ford, whose career got off to a promising start. His first short film played at Sundance and was shortlisted for Oscar. Then, for 12 long years, he couldn't get a feature film off the ground. That is, until busy actress Aubrey Plaza committed to produce and star in the project, which she definitely didn't do for money.
Back in the day, before my time, you know, a $2 million movie could go to Sundance and get the reviews that we've gotten and really be a real success. And it would motivate people to make movies like this because you felt like you hit the jackpot. But that business model doesn't really happen anymore.
Aubrey Plaza and John Patton Ford talk very candidly about the struggle to make Ford's well-reviewed debut film, Emily the Criminal. But first, we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague and banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, a lot of news. Let's start with the looming strike. As you know, the Writers Guild, normally the most aggressive in these situations of the guilds, had a vote to authorize a strike if they can't make a deal with the producers, with the studios. And almost 98% of those voting, and a majority, I think, did vote, voted for the strike authorization. So it seems that the writers are extremely amped up and really sick of the whole thing. They feel that the streaming revolution has really hurt them. They don't make the money that they used to. They have to scramble. They don't get residuals. All these grievances. This has been a fight that was looming for a long time, and now it's here. And I guess the question is, what are the other major guilds involved here, the Directors Guild and SAG-AFTRA, going to do?
Well, it's interesting because the timing and how this lines up is going to dictate how these guilds react, because obviously the writers have a May 1st deadline, which is why they authorized the strike this week. And the other guilds, SAG and the DGA, have a June deadline. So they have said that they're negotiating, but they're going after the writers. So what the writers do here is really going to dictate how this all plays out.
Yeah, it doesn't look like we will have a situation where the directors, who usually make the deal fastest and least contentiously, are going to now undercut the writers by saying, okay, we have a deal. It looks like they are going to hold back and let the writers fight this out. And the other side of that coin, of course, is the studios may, at least they're leading people to believe, they may be like, okay, fine, we'll just cut a bunch of deals and save a bunch of money. I don't know how much of that is bravado, but to some of it, I think is real.
Oh, I think it's definitely real, especially when you look at some of the content cost cuts that are going on across the industry. I mean, people are looking at some of these major deals that were signed even 1, 2, 3 years ago and saying, well, this doesn't really make sense anymore. We have this opportunity, put that in quote marks, to get rid of some of those deals. They don't want a strike, but if a strike happens, they can certainly take advantage of it in the short term.
Yes. So that is something that is going to cause a lot of anxiety and potentially a lot of economic fallout in Los Angeles. Not good for the city and the many people who make their living in the entertainment industry. Let me turn to Netflix. Netflix, Ted Sarandos said in the last few days, you know, I think we can ride this out better than a lot of other places. So good for Netflix, I guess. They announced some results for the first quarter that were kind of Rashomon. Some analysts were like, this is fine. Others were like, not so fine. But whatever that is, Netflix for sure is going to be coming for that password sharing because they need to goose their revenue.
Yeah, this is the gradual and then all at once shift of Netflix from a growth subscriber-oriented company to a profitability-oriented company. And the revenue and profits they're projecting for the year are pretty aggressive. And to get there, they're going to have to squeeze people. And one of the ways they're doing it is this password sharing initiative, which they've tested around the world. They announced at the earnings call that it's finally coming to the U.S. So alas, if you get Netflix from your parents or your ex-girlfriend or whoever, you're going to get a subtle reminder that you have to start paying. And they have these different plans to hopefully move you over for a discounted price where you will be added to the person's account who you have been taking it from and for an upcharge. And they hope that that's value add to the company and brings these people into the Netflix fold as paying subscribers.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes. I mean, they didn't grow much in the States where it's long been saturated, but there's all those people out there, some of whom I may know personally, who are on somebody else's account.
Yeah, you may be related to one. Is that perhaps the case?
Absolutely no comment on that. let me turn to Fox Dominion. A lot of people out there who are not fans of Fox News were crushed that Fox settled with Dominion, the voting machine company. And what they really wanted was the display, first of all, of the trial with big stars on Fox News testifying, but also, if they were going to settle, they wanted Fox personalities like Tucker Carlson to go on the air and, as a part of the deal, say, you know what? I lied and I knew I was lying about the 2020 election. Now, that didn't happen and obviously couldn't happen when you think about the fact that there is, even as we speak, more litigation looming against Fox in the same vein, for example, from Smartmatic, and who knows what other kinds of lawsuits are going to be filed.
Right. And the Smartmatic case is a $2.7 billion case, which is $1.1 billion more than what Dominion was asking for. So the stakes are still very high here. And that's why when you look at the Fox statement that they issued after the ruling, it is very heavily negotiated, heavily lawyered, and they don't actually admit anything wrong. They don't apologize. They only say that they acknowledge the court's findings that certain things about Dominion that aired on Fox were false. Then they go on to say that they have a commitment to high standards of journalism, and then let's put this all behind us. But yes, that's clearly designed to not come back to haunt them later in other cases.
Yes, I'm sure they said to Dominion, we'll give you this much money. We can't admit to wrongdoing. This is as far as we can go. And the number got to be right. Hence what I will refer to as the lawyer's weasel words. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, a founding partner of Puck News. In director John Patton Ford's debut film, Emily the Criminal, actress and producer Aubrey Plaza plays a young artist burdened with tens of thousands in student loans. One day, as Emily slogs through her low-paid catering gig, a coworker offers her the chance to make some extra cash. Emily soon finds herself in the back room of a nondescript business where she and several others are being briefed on their mission.
Can I have a card, please? In a few minutes, you would go to the store and buy some merchandise. Any of these flat screens is okay. Just buy one, and then wheel it outside. We pick up the merchandise and we pay you. And that's it for today.
These are stolen, right?
The information on them is stolen, yes.
And thus begins Emily's career on the wrong side of the law. Emily the Criminal is the farthest thing from a studio movie. It was made for a very low budget and shot in just 21 days. Nothing about it was easy, but after debuting at Sundance, the film now sits with a 94% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Somebody asked me to talk to a class, students at USC who were like in this producing class a couple of weeks ago. You know, we were talking about all the Marvel and the this and the big Top Gun Maverick. One of them was like, but what about independent film? And I know that they listen to this show. So you are here to give them heart, I think, to some degree, at least. John, you earned your MFA, your fine arts degree at the master's at the FI. We don't want to make them too happy right out of the gate, so we'll talk about the long slog. You made this thesis short film, Patrol. It premieres at Sundance in 2010. I think it was even shortlisted for an Oscar, right, for short film? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And then, well, you earn money, but you're not making movies.
I mean, saying I earn money is being pretty generous. I think it depends what you call money. Yeah, I mean, that's a long story that could easily derail this entire conversation, which I don't want to do. But the short version is that I kind of was like batting 1,000 up until like age 26 or 27 or something. Like I made the short movie that went to Sundance, which is the dream if you're a film student. And I got an agent and a manager and all these cool things that certainly sounded like, you know, what was supposed to happen. And then it took me 12 years to get my first movie made. And there are a lot of reasons for that. The biggest reason is that I just didn't know how to write a feature script at that point. I had gotten really proficient at making short films. That's a different discipline. And it took me a couple of years after film school to kind of get comfortable with writing features. The irony is that by the time I did, I was considered a writer, you know? People were reading my feature scripts, and that led to a job, led to another job. this sounds like not that bad. But the reality is that after I got out of film school, there were like 5 years of me just struggling, working at restaurants, working catering. I worked the same job that the central character in Emily the Criminal has for a number of years. And I don't mean in my early 20s. I mean like up until age 33, I was working in catering kitchens and sweating. And then finally, I had made enough money to kind of quit that and just write full time. And then I wrote this movie to make myself. And it took about 5 years to finally get the money together and do it. It's hard to quantify to people the struggle.
Yes, we're going to talk about that a bit more. So Opry, you've been working pretty cooking along pretty well. And somebody shows you this script from a guy who has been doing all the things that John just talked about. I mean, I think a lot of people would be surprised that you even read it. This wasn't like your agent saying, you should do this.
No, it was one of the producers on the film who was working with me and John in different projects. And I was working with him on a documentary project for years. And he had the script in his hands because he was working with John on something else. And they were trying to find something else to do with me because we were having a really great kind of working collaboration. And yeah, he just thought I'd really enjoy the script. And he kind of slipped it to me. And I think normally when people do that, it takes a long time for people to read scripts. And I'm a pretty fast reader. And this script in particular, it was just one of those scripts that I started to read and I just flew through it. It's so readable and fun. And it's like the movie. It has just like this momentum that propels forward. And it's, I'm pretty ambitious and I'm kind of always looking for like that next thing that I feel could be potentially a great film. So it definitely struck me like immediately when I got my hands on it.
Yeah, I think people do these stunts you hear about, like throwing a script over somebody's wall or something. I assume you had to have some relationship with the person who handed you the script or you probably would have been reluctant to even take a chance.
Yeah, of course. And I think it's kind of the advice that I always give to young people, young filmmakers, and because I went to film school as well. And I remember, you know, that feeling of hopelessness and feeling like, well, I don't even know where to begin. How do I break in or how do I get anything made? And I think it's a really great example of how you never know what could lead to what. The documentary we were working on, we're still working on it. It's still kind of an unfinished project, but because of that, it led to this. So it's kind of, yeah, it's just like, you never know who you can meet down the road. And you might think like, oh, this project is dead. It's not going well or whatever it is. But if you're not open to things, then things kind of won't fall into your lap like that.
Yeah. So John, back to you. You actually like Aubrey's character in the film. You came out of school with a lot of debt, which I think clearly must have weighed on you. I think I read an interview where you talked about like how debilitating. It's something you clearly used in the film.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to make something that I had real emotional authority over, especially for a first movie. I was like, I want to make something where I know how this person feels. I don't have to do research or do guesswork. I want to just know, like in my heart of hearts, what is right. And so there was very little that would be more appropriate than making like a student loan anxiety thriller. You know, I was living that for a long time.
Aubry, you said you're very ambitious and obviously producing attracts you and not just nominal vanity type producing credits that certain people like to have.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to make a great movie. I love acting and I love challenging myself and doing different roles, but I really just love movies. And there's just something that really gets me going when I feel like I can have a real impact on every part of the process. And once I discovered that with Ingrid Goes West, and I kind of followed that movie from the very first stages to the very, very end, like I just could never, my brain just exploded. I just was like, oh man, I want to do this all the time. And it doesn't matter if I'm in it or not, but it's great to be in it as well, because I get to kind of like pick roles that I really, really love. I just want to make really great films that are memorable, that don't just like disappear into the ether and that people actually, you know, remember and they want to maybe see it again or they think about it.
Well, good news. It's working on me with Emily the Criminal. I've been thinking about the movie since I saw it. So it worked. So the money, I mean, Aubry, I assume, is a key part of getting financing. You have a recognizable person, a respected, well-regarded person now saying they want to do this movie.
Yeah, I can talk about it a little bit because when I read the script, I saw this movie as a way bigger budget film, a bigger budget than I had ever produced before. And I was pretty adamant that I didn't want to make the movie for less because I wanted to do it right. And even though it's a small movie, it still has, it's kind of written like an action movie, like a thriller with these set pieces and car chase sequences. And I wanted more to do it right. And that wasn't happening. And, you know, it's hard for me to have perspective on how valuable my name is and how much foreign value I have and all that stuff. And it changes all the time. And up until that point, we couldn't really even get $3 million, which is a great number for an indie film. But I've never had that before. And shooting in Los Angeles is very, very expensive. So we tried to put the money, a comfortable budget together for a couple of years, and it wasn't working. And then John connected with Tyler Davidson at Low Sparks Film, who I think basically they were kind of willing to do the movie on a lower budget and felt like we can figure this out.
What were you hearing like from these people? Like, it's too this, it's not enough that? What kind of reasons were people giving you?
People just don't want to make independent films. You don't make money off of them. It's not a good business.
in success, yes, but it's risky, obviously, very risky.
I don't know. In success, yes, maybe. But I mean, I'd love to see an example of a real, true independent film that makes a lot of money these days. Because when you talk about independent films now, the scope is really wide. You know, back in the day, in before my time, I think, you know, a $2 million movie could go to Sundance and get the reviews that we've gotten and really be a real success. And it would motivate people to make movies like this because you felt like you hit the jackpot. But that business model doesn't really happen anymore. But maybe I'm jaded. But it feels pretty hard. I think people are pretty hesitant to put their money into independent films. So it's a struggle always. It has to come from passion because it's not a good business to make money.
What do you think, John? Do you feel like you won or you won with an asterisk?
Given the challenges, I feel like I won. And I'll take the win. I think there are a couple of just like hard truths to negotiate and to deal with. I mean, one of them is that Aubrey and I grew up in a time with home video and that doesn't exist anymore. And that is endemically what has changed the entire system. So it used to be that you could make a sort of independent movie that like doesn't have to do that well at the box office because it'll make its money back afterwards with rentals. But now with streaming, you have streaming services that just pay low prices for things in perpetuity, wholesale. It's a very different market. So things like our movie don't make a lot of financial sense. I also wanted to make this movie for $5 million, but I couldn't help but look at all the acquisition numbers from the previous year. And I just thought there's no way someone's going to give us more money to make this than anything like this has sold for in the past 3 years. I'm not an economist, but I don't think that's going to happen. And then the other thing is like fear. The main reason that stuff gets made in Hollywood, and this is cynical and I apologize for saying this, but it is my truth. Most things happen because of fear. Big movies get made because the executives are scared not to make them for fear that someone else might make them or for fear that they'll be held accountable by their superiors for not having acted upon what appears to be a very economic opportunity. So if you know that, you can reverse it and go, okay, I'm going to get something small made because of fear, right? I wanted to make this movie. So I've got these producers who are convinced they're going to get $5 million. I'm sitting there, the only millennial in the bunch, like, that's not happening. So I went back to my friends from film school. I was like, let's drop a budget for Union Tier Zero like we actually know how to do. And we did. And I was like, I can make it for this amount of money. And hey, look, it could sell for $1 million more than that. And at that point, thriller, sellable, Aubrey Plaza, Union Tier Zero, people start to get scared of saying no. And that, to me, is the primary reason the movie actually got made. It became a deal that enough people felt they couldn't quite pass up on.
Wow. I would say never apologize for cynicism in Hollywood.
I mean, I don't mean to discount the passion involved either. It's kind of unfair just to leave it at that. I mean, the reason it got made at heart is because people believed in it. Aubrey believed in it. She really did. And she didn't have to.
But you're talking about...
I'm nobody.
You're talking about money people, I think.
Yes, the people who actually made the film were not like part of that conversation at all. There were people there because they believed in it. They were passionate. They thought it could be good. And God bless them.
I think we're upsetting this USC students. I probably is a little overly rosy because I said something like storytellers want to tell stories and they'll find a way, which is true, but you're adding a lot
of other
information.
And look, I mean, Look, it doesn't even matter what I'm saying right now. By the time those students are out in the world, it'll be a different system than what we have right now. The stuff that people told
me. Yeah, pretty good about what I said.
The lessons I got in film school, it's like someone teaching you how to like spin yarn at this point. Like the world that they will inherit will be far different, and they'll be the ones who know how to navigate it.
Coming up after the break, Aubrey Plaza and John Patton Ford talk about the challenge of getting a theatrical release for Emily the Criminal. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're revisiting our conversation with Aubrey Plaza and John Patton Ford from September 2022. In their film, Emily the Criminal, Aubrey Plaza plays a young woman whose struggle to pay off student loans draws her into increasingly treacherous illegal schemes. The film is set largely in the criminal underworld, but it also touches on accepted business practices that may be legal but are hardly ethical. When Emily's high school friend gets her an interview for a legitimate job, Emily is shocked to learn from her prospective boss, played by Gina Gershon, that she's expected to start full-time, but with no salary.
You do realize this is a very competitive position.
Yeah, sure, I understand that. What I don't understand is how you feel so comfortable asking someone to work without pay.
You know, when I was your age, they told me all I could be was a secretary.
Okay, but secretaries get paid.
That's not the point.
Well, when you were my age, did you have $60,000 of debt?
How about this? When I was your age, I was the only woman in a room full of men.
But you had a job.
Emily the Criminal is John Patton Ford's first feature film. He and actress-producer Aubrey Plaza say they struggled to find financing and wound up a few million dollars short of their initial goal. You wanted about five and ended up with about two? Is that what happened?
I'd say roughly we can say that's pretty close, but...
Okay.
But yeah.
I can say we made it for the most amount of money you can possibly make a union tier zero movie for in the city of Los Angeles.
Okay.
So if you're that curious, get online and see what that number is.
Google that thing, yeah.
Google it.
It was not a lot, though. I think people are shocked to find out how much we made the movie for. It's shocking.
And was there a distribution idea in place? How is the distribution thing managed?
No, we wanted to take it to a festival.
Well, we had raised a lot of the money by selling the foreign rights of the movie to Universal International.
Mm. Oh, right.
So
sure,
a lot of the reason the movie got made is because Verve, my agency, figured out a way to leverage like the international value of the movie into money we could cash flow, which was an absolute phenomenon that I cannot believe they pulled off.
Well, that's what, I mean, I'm definitely, forgive me for invoking the Weinsteins, but that was their play back in long ago, right?
Pre-sell yeah, but that foreign. Was with like, we're talking, I mean, those were like Steven Seagal movies. For agents to somehow spin this one, I still don't know how they did it. And in fact, there's only
the
one of them
did
year.
It with Independence, but yeah. Yes, I get your point.
But like, to Aubrey's point, the plan was to go to a big festival and sell the domestic kind of distribution of the movie, which is where the real value is, I think, in its perception to the public. So... we were fingers crossed.
And talk to me about how that went, that plan.
I don't think you could have had a better festival experience in terms of the feedback that we got on the film. Unfortunately, it was virtual, so we didn't get to experience it, you know, in person.
Oh, yeah, that's a bummer.
It was really sad. We wanted to be in person. But yeah, I don't think you could have a better kind of, I don't know. I mean, the reviews were great. People loved it. It felt almost like a... surprise. I think people just were surprised by it. It felt really good. I think we had those conversations of, you know, are we going to sell this to someone that wants to do a traditional theatrical release or not? And, you know, those conversations were had. And
what was the thinking on the release? You know, I don't know if there was a streamer in the game. I'm not sure. You tell me.
We had a handful of offers after Sundance, which I should say is a massive privilege. because you're in like the 10% of movies that actually get into that situation after Sundance.
But we didn't have a big streamer come and try to swoop the movie away.
No.
Which I was shocked about. I was shocked by that. I was like, this is weird. Like, you can't do better than this movie, and we're still not getting Amazon, Apple. No, they're not knocking down the door, but okay.
Yeah.
I mean, Apple rolled up to the festival ready to spend upwards of $20 million on one movie. So instead of buying five or six movies, what they'd rather do is buy one movie, because that creates press and that creates conversation. The headline will be, Apple pays this much money for a movie. This is the move of a company that doesn't really concern themselves with profiting from entertainment because they have a whole other business.
Yes.
So to say they're like this party that maybe we'll sell to, it's just, I don't know. Like, yeah, good luck.
None of the streamers bought movies this year.
Yeah, no, they didn't.
They just didn't.
No. What they'd rather do is have someone else buy the movie for cheaper, and then the streamers are going to sit back and see how that does. And if it does well, they're going to buy it off of that
right. Kind
of middleman. And that is exactly precisely what happened to us. We sold the movie to a wonderful distributor that were committed to theatrical. And the streaming life of the movie will happen later, kind of down the road, instead of selling directly to a streamer.
So I will just say there's a deal, an as yet to be announced deal, but you have not come away empty-handed. Can we put it that way?
Sure.
Okay. So you go through these 12 years, John, of wandering in the wilderness. You get there with this fabulous actress, producer who is determined as you are to make the film happen. You get your way through this challenging shoot. You make it to the festival. You get a sale. On a 10-point scale in today's world, is that a 10 as a win, or does it feel like I wish I had been doing this in an earlier era where people bought DVDs?
Oh, no. I mean, it's a 10. It's a win. I can sit here and go, oh, I wish I'd been born in, 1945. That would have been cool. I mean, that was just, you're crushing it, But like, what are you going to do? I mean, I think given the situation, given the context, I think this was a miracle for me to end up like this. I mean, look, I'm sitting here in my apartment. A car's about to pick me up, take me to LAX. I'm going to fly to France for a film festival, like in 2 hours.
Mm. And is your phone ringing more? Is this opening doors, more doors?
It is. It's been an exciting time, but a confusing time as well, trying to figure out what exactly to do. And of course, I have to make a living, and that only makes it more complicated. So I'll take the win, and I'm grateful for it. That doesn't mean that it's simple or that it's straightforward either. Just imagine that you're broke and like you don't have health insurance, and then 10 months later, you're somehow turning down a big studio project for fear that even though it would pay you a lot, it would be bad and damage your career. These are incredibly difficult decisions to make. And there's just no instruction manual for it. And there are very few people who can provide advice who don't have some kind of investment in my life or skin in the game. It's tricky, but those are problems that I feel grateful to have.
Yeah, we have seen it happen, too much too soon. It's not a good thing. Aubrey, you're doing White Lotus. I'm excited about that.
Yeah.
Love the first season. And you have a myriad opportunities and have had for some time, I think. But you seem to love this. So how are you going to sort out your days of a little bit of this and some of that?
Honestly, I think I'll probably direct soon. I think I'm getting to a place where it's time for that to happen. And I think it's like John says, there's no manual on how to navigate these kinds of things. But I just want to keep being inspired and, working with people that I really believe in and that I love collaborating with. So I think it's just back to the drawing board, I guess. Find another script, either write it myself or find it, or I don't know. But I just want to make good movies, really. I mean, I like doing television, but I'm more interested in making really great movies. So I'll just do whatever I can to keep trying to do that.
Well, so far, you're off to a rolling start, that's for sure. Aubrey Plaza starred in and produced Emily the Criminal. John Patton Ford wrote and directed the film. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Matt Schwartz, Paul Smith, and John Meek, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW shows on kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.